This is a production of Cornell University.
I am going to go ahead and call the meeting to order. If you could get the roll call, please.
Okay. Lila Abed Al-Jameed.
Present.
Dylan Ondekat.
Excuse.
Morgan Baker. Genevieve Bansaw.
Here.
Katarina Bentley.
Present.
Kayla Butler.
Present.
Carlo Castillo.
Present.
Uchenna Chukwukere.
Present.
Lucy Contreras.
Present.
Annette Gleiberman. Sonu Kapoor.
Present.
Amari Lampert.
Present.
Andrea Miramontes Serrano.
Present.
Evan Moy.
Excused.
Jocelyn Noriega.
Unexcused.
Estefania Perez.
Present.
Tomas Running. Kate Santa Cruz.
Present.
Mardia Shardo. Lucas Smith.
Present.
Claire Templeman.
Present.
Valeria Valencia.
Present.
Noah Watson.
Here.
Salam Waldai.
Present.
Valentina Shu.
Present.
Johan Yuan.
Present.
Raquel Zohar.
Excused.
Lucas Zumpano. Pano.
Zumpano, yeah.
Zumpano, sorry. Samuel Zevevres.
You just say Z because you just say it completely wrong every single time.
Okay.
You just say Samuel Z, that's totally fine.
Samuel Z, sorry about that. And Catherine Wong.
Present. Thank you so much, Kira. I also do believe that Mardia and Morgan Baker are both here. I'm not sure.
I'm here, yeah. I just out for a second. Sorry.
No, I think it's just like mics and everything. So just wanted to mark them as present as I do see them in our participants. Could we get the count of members, please? Thank you so much.
I have 24.
Thank you. Okay, great. We have 24 members present. I'm officially calling the meeting to order. Okay, sorry. We still have people coming in. It's fine. Okay, I'm going to move ahead with the land acknowledgement as was implemented in understanding rules by last week's resolution. So I'm just going to read the land acknowledgement right now. Cornell University is located on the traditional homelands of the Gayogono, the Cayuga Nation. The Gayogono are members of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, an alliance of six sovereign nations with a historic and contemporary presence on this land. The Confederacy precedes the establishment of Cornell University, New York State, and the United States of America. We acknowledge the painful history of Gayogono dispossession and honor the ongoing connection with Gayogono people, past and present, to these lands and waters. Thanks, everyone. Okay. We're going to move ahead with announcements and presentations. Vice President Watson, take it away.
Thank you, Kat. So today we have two presentations, and one is from a community member slash alumnus of Cornell, Mr. Daniel Brown. He also is the executive director of a local nonprofit called Racker, and he has invited a few other people to come briefly speak to us around 5 minutes, and they are Jennifer Tavares, the CEO of Tompkins County Chamber of Commerce, Jason Molino, who's a Tompkins County administrator, and also Dr. Martin Stallone, who is the CEO of Cayuga Medical Center. So I plan for them to speak around 5 o'clock, but if they're all here, I'd be more than willing to let them go ahead. I don't know.
I know, I'm not sure if they're all here, but I'll look.
Yeah, I see two of you, but if not, then we can go ahead on our agenda and move into open microphone, possibly. Okay, is that okay?
Sure, that sounds okay. Good.
Very cool. So we're now going to move into open microphone. If any members of the community wish to speak, please raise your hand and we will unmute you. And we'll leave this open for about 30 seconds. I'm going to close open microphone. And Kat, I think we can also go ahead to the minutes.
Sure. All righty. So I do believe the minutes were included in the agenda. Thanks to Noah for including them. I'm going to allow about a minute for everyone to read through the minutes if you haven't already. And then we will see if there is a motion to approve after that. But please, everyone, take a moment to review them. Alrighty, has everyone had time to review the minutes? I see nods, great. Is there any motion to approve the minutes?
Motion to approve.
Great. Motion seconded.
Thank you, is there any dissent? Wonderful, seeing no dissent, we'll move into voting. Please use the participants' yes or no buttons to vote on approving the minutes right now. I'll close voting in 30 seconds. And only SA members will vote. I'm still waiting on a few members to cast their votes. Waiting on just a few more people. And if you're going to abstain, you can message me privately. Mardia, can I ask you to cast your vote or message me privately? Okay, I'm closing voting in 5 seconds. Okay, 23-0-2, the minutes have been approved. Noah, back to you for announcements and our guests. Again, welcome to all of our guests.
Yes, so it looks like all of our guests are here. So we're gonna give them around 5 minutes or so, however long they need. If you guys would like to go ahead, possibly Mr. Brown.
Ed and Noah, thank you guys so much for giving me this opportunity to express my appreciation to the students at Cornell University. When I saw the announcement this summer that all students were coming back to Cornell for the fall semester, I was sure that it would be a disaster. I was thinking back to my Cornell days in the early 80s and thinking, no way would I have had the discipline for mask wearing and social distancing, and mix that with a lack of discipline with a long tradition of rowdy Greek house parties and tight on-campus housing, 20,000 students from 50 states and 70 countries. I was sure we had a recipe for a pandemic disaster. Well, you have proved me wrong. And as a Cornell alumnus from 82, I could not be prouder. The students at Cornell deserve to be recognized by the local community. Your actions have met the highest standards of ethical behavior by promoting trust, fairness, kindness, self-sacrifice, and generosity. And I also have a short note from James Brown, president of the Tompkins County United Way. During this unprecedented time, community has taken on greater meaning as the lines between individual responsibility and collective health and safety are more connected than ever. Cornell students have assumed an important leadership role in Tompkins County's response, recovery, and rebuilding from the COVID-19 pandemic. Your efforts have contained community spread and strengthened local lives and commerce. United Way volunteers and staff, thank you. And now I'd like to introduce Jason Molino, the Tompkins County Administrator.
Thank you, Dan. I second everything you just said. My name is Jason Molino. I'm the Tompkins County Administrator, and my responsibility is to oversee the operations of the county, which includes the Public Health Department, which has been leading in the public response and oversight over this pandemic. I can tell you back in really mid-January, as we were starting to see beginnings of some cases come in and having the conversation with our public health director and some of our staff, wanting to make sure that we were in constant communication with higher ed, particularly with Cornell. And as we were preparing for students to come back and as the pandemic was starting to really come into New York State, Cornell took a very proactive action in March, which many folks criticized. But I think that initial action was an important piece of protecting the community. Equally so, when the summer came around and it was time for students to come back, our communication and partnership with Cornell has never been better. And I would agree with Dan, many of members of the community felt that the students were going to bring chaos in the community. And it's somewhat nice to see that not happen. And some of them coming forward and saying, you know what, I was wrong. You have shown immense leadership in the community. You have taken a road less traveled. You have demonstrated that you are members of the community, leaders in the community. And really, to be honest with you, because of your actions, the community is much safer. And I know on behalf of the county legislature, I can't thank you enough. They can't thank you enough. It's been a great partnership. I think our relationship with Cornell has never been stronger. Our relationship with all of the higher ed institutions have been stronger. It's ironic it took a global pandemic to do it, but nonetheless, your leadership as leaders in the community is shining and can be seen from afar. So I want to thank you for all of that. I want to thank you for your dedication and commitment. Hope you all have a good holiday, and we'll look forward to seeing you come back some of you might stay here, but if you don't, you come back, we see you come the new year, and we look forward to continuing this moving forward. You've really set an example, not only in the community, across the state, and across the nation. You should know that Tompkins County has the lowest infection rate per capita in New York State, and thankfully, unfortunately, we've had one passing, but the lowest death rate per capita in New York State. And I think that is a huge part because of your actions. So thank you. And you deserve to congratulate yourselves for your hard work and effort. With that, I will introduce Dr. Martin Stallone. I don't know if Dr. Stallone is on. He is.
I'm here.
Dr. Stallone is also a huge, big partner in this. And I can't thank Cayuga Medical Center and Cayuga Health Systems for their partnership in all this. But Dr. Stallone, you're on.
Thank you, Jason. I echo everything Jason said and Dan Brown for his kind words. And hello to the students. I'm Dr. Marty Stallone, as Jason mentioned, the CEO of Cayuga Health System. I'm also a Cornell alum, Cal's class of 98, so go Big Red. I wanted to take this opportunity to personally express how proud our medical community and our hospital is about how you have all conducted yourselves during this difficult time, really during a crisis. From testing program compliance to social distancing, to mask wearing in a responsible manner and limiting the gatherings that you've had on and off campus, you've all done an exceptional job. You've done your part. We want to express our gratitude and encourage you particularly to keep up the good work. We know this has been difficult, but then again, the most important things we do are often the hardest. As you continue to be responsible, I ask you to remember something. Beyond your actions enabling in-person classes to happen and your school to open, those actions protected members of our community for whom the virus has more dire consequences than it might among a college population. So on behalf of those individuals and their family and loved ones and the averted morbidity and mortality victims of this horrible scourge of a pandemic, I thank you for how you're handling this so responsibly. And so I'm gonna now hand it off to Jennifer Tavares, CEO of the Chamber of Commerce for the county. Jennifer.
Thanks, Marty. Well, I just can echo everything everyone already said. I am the president of the chamber, but we are also the Convention and Visitors Bureau. And so we have a lot of local businesses within our sort of our purview, both for, you know, small local businesses you might love from downtown to college town to major employers you might not be as familiar with. And certainly all of the visitation and all of the other economic activity that you stimulate in the community. And so I think maybe some of our stakeholders were maybe a little more open and maybe slightly less fearful than the average group of people about student return. We probably had a lot of people that were much more supportive of the idea of students coming back because their livelihoods depend on you being here and all of the activity that you stimulate when you are in our community. It can't be understated how much all of these things are connected, how many people's daily lives you influence, both through your actions to be safe and to be respectful and to help us take care of our community during this really difficult time, but also when you choose to invest your money and your resources and your family chooses to visit, or, you know, under normal times, I know you'd all be able to have more visitors and more friends and family come and see you. And so just want to say we have a huge amount of respect for you. We know this has been a really difficult semester, a very hard time. We knew you could do it, but you just absolutely blew our expectations out of the water. We hope that as many of you as possible will come back again in the spring, maybe even more of you now that everyone knows how well this can go. And certainly we want to be here to support you returning to the community and visiting in the long term. We know that some part of your experience here hasn't been what you had hoped it would be, but rest assured, Ithaca and Tompkins County will be here for a very long time for you to come back to, and we'll do everything we can to make your time here really special. So again, we're so grateful. What you've done is hugely meaningful to our community, and it really does impact so many people, everything from workers at area businesses all the way up to business owners and everything in between. And so thank you so much on behalf of the business community. And our hospitality community. And I hope you have a wonderful holiday season, whatever it is that you celebrate, and that we'll get a chance to talk again next semester. Thanks so much.
Wow. Thank you so, so much, Mr. Brown, Mr. Molino, Dr. Stallone, and Ms. Taveras. Thank you so much for being here and for your kind words and encouragement. And also, I want to completely recognize this is such a team effort. As students wouldn't be here, you know, without the support of the Ithaca community and the leadership from Tompkins County Administration, such as yourself. Also, speaking as like an out-of-state student who came here, I'm so like happy to be here and to be welcomed into Tompkins County. So thank you all so much. Do we have any SA members who would also like to say a few words? Please raise your hand if so. Yes, Andrea?
As an international student, I would really like to appreciate the fact that, as Kat said, this has all been a like, group effort, and everyone's part has been like greatly, has had a great impact on the turnout. And again, I just wanted to emphasize that people from everywhere are really happy to be here. And I think I can say we're all really like content with how it has come, and it hasn't been that bad because we are here in the end. So yeah, I just wanted to highlight that, and thank you to you as well for making this possible.
Thank you, Andrea. And then now we have Lucas Smith.
Yeah, also I think also directing the thank yous again right back at you all for making this such an amazing community. I think I've had the chance to certainly sit in on a bunch of town halls that you've all participated in over the summer, kind of listening in for a student perspective or whatnot. And it's been incredible just to see the resources that have been dedicated really from all of your organizations to make sure that this is successful for us, which speaks to, like Kat said, that team effort. And it's certainly been a joy for us to be able to contribute back to Tompkins County. And I've been impressed with, you know, the opportunities that have been presented for myself and certainly for all of my peers to jump in and work with different nonprofits and just give back and keep things going here in Tompkins County. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Lucas. And lastly, we have Samuel.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, I think the student body has done a great job keeping up with all the rules and regulations that we've been asked to uphold. And I think that a huge part of it was also the ability of Cornell Health in teamwork and in unison with Cayuga Medical Centers. The fact that we have such robust testing and health protocols, I know a lot of my friends that go to other universities and that are present in other healthcare systems, they're tested randomly. Some have had their first COVID test just this week for the entire semester, while me and my peers have been testing since the first day of school that we got here twice a week. Robust testing centers. We have quarantine in the Statler and other buildings for quarantining. And I just think overall the administration has done a phenomenal job making sure that we keep our cases low. And it's definitely a huge harmony of students and administration working together to have had such a successful result.
Thank you so much, Samuel. And again, just, I feel like we're just hearing so many thank yous. So just thanks all around. And again, thank you so much for coming here to recognize this joint effort. We really appreciate you all taking the time out to attend our meeting and to come speak with us as students.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Thank you. Have a wonderful rest of your evenings.
Thank you. Be well.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you all so much. Okay, great. Oh, that was so sweet. Okay, back to Noah, if you have any more announcements and presentations.
Yes, we do. And I'm going to hand it off to Uche. He has a teach-in for all of us.
Thank you, Noah. Can I actually get power to share my screen?
Just yep. Enabled it.
Yes. Thank you. All right. One moment. All right, can everybody see my screen okay? Go ahead. All right, hi everyone. So yes, today I and a couple of my friends are going to be giving y'all a teach-in about police disarmament. So as we know, and as we've been seeing for the past few weeks, months, years, the rise in cases of police brutality and the issues with policing in America, and some of the calls and movements to disarm, defund, and disband police departments all across America. And on this campus, it's really important that for SA members that we stay informed and we're up to date about what it means when we talk about disarming and why, and what it means to defund and why, and what it means to disband and some of the reasonings why. So today we're going to be giving a teach-in on police disarmament. So I'm going to have some of my co-presenters, say their names, year, and I guess any org affiliations that you may want to bring up. So if we could start with Kat, to introduce yourself.
Hi, everyone. I'm Kat, and I'm an RLRE current senior, and I'm involved with the Cornell Abolitionist Revolutionary Society.
And then we'll have Lucy.
Hi, everyone. My name is Lucy. I am the SA First Gen Rep, and I'm a senior.
Sherelle.
Hi, everyone. I'm Sherelle. I'm a junior in ILR, and I'm also a member of the Cornell Abolitionist Revolutionary Society.
Myself, so yeah, y'all know me. I'm Uche. Apart from the SA, I'm also one of the co-founders of the Do Better Cornell campaign. I've been doing work with CARS and collaborating with them among other student organizations. And then lastly, Connor.
Hi everyone, I'm Connor. I'm a senior in the College of Arts and Sciences. I'm coming back from a few years away. I'm in the College Scholar Program and I study transformations in policing in the 1960s and in the global war on terror period. So I was asked to come along and talk about a little literature review I did and a little bit about the history of campus policing.
Okay, beautiful. All right, so to give y'all a general outline of what we'll be talking about today, so we're going to go and first talk a little bit about the history of policing. We're going to talk about its origins of, starting out in slavery and slave patrols, having discussion about ugly laws, policing of race, class, and disabilities. Reconstruction, policing, the Jim Crow era, civil rights era, as well as moving into what policing looks like in the 2000s, talking more about cases of police brutalities and ethical issues with guns. Then we're going to move into discussing policing on college campuses and having discussions about issues and the arguments on why police should not be armed on campuses, as well as talking about alternative campus solutions to policing and current actions being taken on other college campuses. All right, sorry. All right.
Take it away. Okay. Thanks, Uche. I just knocked over pins, y'all. Thanks, Uche, for kicking us off. So to understand and have this really important conversation about police disarmament, it's really important that we understand the history and situate ourselves in it. So policing originated from slave patrols. Slaves, when they were when they ran away, these squadrons of white volunteers were sent out to find them, to crush uprisings and punish enslaved workers who they thought violated any plantation rules. From those squadrons, we got our first police forces that were overwhelmingly white, male, and instead of being focused on crushing actual crime, they went to respond to disorder, which was more so like labor agitation. So working class folks trying to better their conditions were being punished and policed by these overwhelmingly white male people. Police have been used to uphold and enforce racist laws since slavery, and that includes Black codes, which prevented people from holding certain jobs, from owning property. And then from Black codes, we have the Jim Crow laws, which most of us, I think, should be well aware of, which stop Black people from doing things like drinking at water fountains, sitting at the front of the bus. And the lists are exhaustive, and police were used to uphold those racist laws.
Another example of one of these racist laws were the Ugly Laws, which were early forms of policing that targeted primarily low-income and disabled folks, and also Black folks as well. The first ordinances were passed way back in 1860s, but then thereafter were also passed in the 1880s and 1890s. And basically the Ugly Laws prohibited folks who had noticeable physically presenting disabilities from visiting public spaces. And again, it disproportionately targeted folks at the intersection of race, income, and disability status. And the reason for like why we included this slide is to show the ways in which the police basically have to enforce laws which are incredibly racist and hit the most marginalized communities. Then for our next history of the policing slide, we have the Reconstruction era prisons. As many folks know from the documentary from the word, the documentary escapes me, 13th, I think. A lot of folks know about mass incarceration and how it originated. After the abolishment of slavery, some former plantations were converted into prison labor camps, wherein it was mostly populated by young Black men. Obviously, the police would arrest them based on false accusations many times. And because prisoners were excluded from those protections, they were forced to labor for free in these camps. And then under convict leasing, they were imprisoned and sold back to plantation owners where they would do the same labor. And the image on this slide, you can see folks who are prisoners actually working cotton fields. And again, it just reifies this idea that like slavery hasn't really gone away. We still have prison labor to this day, and folks will be working for very low wages. I know, especially in the California wildfires, there's been a lot of media coverage on incarcerated folks working as firefighters, but once they are let go from prison, they're not allowed to become firefighters, even though they have that skill set. And again, like mass incarceration, again, disproportionately affects Black folks. Anna, we mentioned it in the chat, it's 13th, and you can find it on Netflix.
Okay, so I think it's important that we talk about, you know, we hear a lot about what police brutality. I know we've all heard that come up a lot for years, and I think it's really important that we define what it is. So police brutality is the use of excessive or unnecessary force by personnel affiliated with law enforcement duties when dealing with suspects and civilians. So, you know, to go into a little bit statistics about police brutality, there were from 2015 to 2020, there have been 5,367 fatal police shootings. In the case of armed victims, Native Americans were killed by police at a rate 3 times that of white people. Black people were killed at 2.6 times the rate of white people. And Hispanics were killed at nearly 1.3 times the rate of white people. Among unarmed victims, Black people were killed at 3 times the rate and Hispanics at 1.4 times the rate of white people. So there are a lot of factors that contribute to police brutality. So you can read them. We gave a couple of examples right here. Some of them include aggressive defense of police officers and resistance to change in police unions. So you can probably see across a lot of movements how across the nation where a lot of people are calling for reform and changes to the police departments. And, you know, there are specific examples that we can look at where police officers, police unions are very resistant to making these changes within the police departments. There are also broad legal protections granted to police officers. So I don't know if anyone's ever heard of qualified immunity, but qualified immunity is a judicially created doctrine that shields government officials from being held personally liable for constitutional violations. So an example of where qualified immunity comes into play, there is a case where a 10-year-old child was shot trying to shoot. A 10-year-old child was shot by police while the police officer was trying to shoot a non-threatening family dog. The 11th Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals held that the officer was entitled to qualified immunity because no earlier case held it was unconstitutional for a police officer to recklessly fire his gun into a group of children without justification. The court also declined to establish the rule. Not only was the police officer let off the hook in that case, but the very same officer can act in the same way again and would still be still be entitled to qualified immunity. There are also other factors contributing to police brutality include historic racism of police departments. So I know, you know, Sherelle and Kat were talking about a little bit earlier where, you know, the beginnings of police departments as, you know, slave catchers and slave patrols. The militarization of police, where we see police officers on campus are heavily armed. Adoption of tactics that escalate tension, such as stop and frisk. Inadequacies of police training and or police academies. As it currently stands, on average, police officers only need to train on average between 13 to 19 weeks. So it would take you a longer amount of time to become a barber or a hairdresser, which is on average around 10 months than it would be to train to become a police officer. And then also the psychology of, of possessing power. So I think another thing that we could point to is the Stanford Prison Experiment, where, you know, I guess if we boil it all down, there were a group of people who participated in this experiment. Some people were put in positions of power. They were guards, officers, and then other people were not in positions of power. They were supposed to act as prisoners. And, you know, studies show that the people who were put in the positions of power eventually ended up abusing it. So, yeah.
Right. So I think Sherelle gave us a neat overview of the origins of the institutions of policing in this country. I'm going to talk a little bit about campus policing in particular. Before the mid-20th century, some universities hired night watchmen. They were primarily responsible for reporting curfew violations and ensuring gender segregation, making sure that the boys stayed in the boys' dorms and the women stayed in the women's dorms. They didn't have any power of arrest. They didn't have any police authority to conduct searches or seizures, and they were never armed. In the 1950s, some universities started hiring retired police administrators to oversee departments of public safety who oversaw their night watchman programs. Then in the 1960s, things particularly picked up in response to the unrest and social agitation around the end of Jim Crow, the civil rights movement, and particularly on college campuses in response to the draft, the drafting of men aged 18 to 24 to go and fight in the war in Vietnam. So New York State was actually at the center of some of these debates over social unrest on college campuses. Most important are the incidents at Columbia and here at Cornell. The bottom left is Columbia, the top right, or the top left is Cornell. In 1968, there were a series of Columbia protests against segregation on campus and Columbia's participation in funding a Pentagon think tank, the Institute for Defense Analyses, which did a lot of counterinsurgency research. The students occupied five administration buildings and demanded that there both be an end to segregation on campus and that the university cut ties with this think tank. The university responded by inviting in 1,000 NYPD officers, as you see in the New York Times headline in the top right, to oust the students. They really beat the hell out of them, dragged them down some marble stairs. It was pretty bloody. And it was also a national news incident. Across the country, folks were aware of this campus uprising and of the response to it. And there was an increased sort of agitation and concern over what was happening on college campuses across the country because of this. In the top left, you see what happened the following year, 1969, April. Those folks are members of the Afro-American Society of Cornell. They're leaving Willard Strait Hall, which they had taken over for over a day in response to a cross that had been burned outside of the Ward Cooperative, the Black Women's Cooperative on campus, and in response to Cornell's lack of funding for the newly established Africana Studies and Research Center. Some folks remember the Willard Strait Hall takeover, as it's usually talked about. They don't remember that in the week prior and the week after, there was actually a series of campus unrest and political agitation, especially in Barton Hall. The president came and at the time came and gave a presentation about the takeover and about the agreement that he had reached with the AAS and the Students for a Democratic Society who had assisted them. And when he left, the 2,000 students in Barton Hall didn't leave. They ended up engaging in this exercise of direct democracy. They called it the Barton Hall community. They stayed there for most of a week. They didn't go to class. And they demanded that the further demands of the AAS and the Students for Democratic Society be met by the administration before they were able to restart campus operations. One of their main demands, in fact, was the construction of a constituent assembly, a university representative body, which would, you know, produce legislation, policy proposals, and send them to the president for approval, which has evolved to the current day, SA, GPSA, UA, et cetera. That picture in the top left, it won the Pulitzer Prize. Again, newspapers across the country, you know, spread the news of this campus protests, this agitation. You know, year after year, this is happening, especially in New York State. The governor of New York State, Nelson Rockefeller, who would later go on to become Gerald Ford's vice president and was one of the leading figures in the GOP at the time, him, Nixon, and Reagan were all competing through the 60s to see who would become president. He pivoted hard to the right on law and order politics. He changed from a rehabilitative model of drug crimes in New York State to what they were called the Rockefeller drug laws, which became a model across the country. And lesser known was his stance on campus unrest. He, especially after the Cornell uprising, he required that universities have rules for the maintenance of public order, which are in all SUNY campus codes of conduct and in Cornell's, which are a series of penalties for folks who engage in disruptive acts and politically motivated acts on college campuses. And he also responded by increasing funding and establishing new funding lines for campus police in response to some of these problems. And these models were copied across the country. So, you know, New York State was really at the center of this, and Cornell was at the center of this as well, this construction of campus police apparatus. Before that, and for a few years after that as well, that you had some incidents, like you see in the bottom right, the famous incident from Kent State. I think this one also won the Pulitzer. Without campus police organizations, when students got too out of hands, the universities would rely on city police, they'd rely on state police, and they'd rely on the National Guard. This picture was actually taken on the fourth day of protests at Kent State, and the National Guard had been running all around campus trying to round up protesters for those 4 days. They eventually got too tired of it and started shooting into the crowd. They killed four. This was in May 1970. And then 11 days later at an HBCU, Jackson State University in Jackson, Mississippi, city police and state police arrived to break up more student protests, and they shot into the crowd and killed three. So with these two examples, and then with the example of Columbia of 1,000 NYPD troopers coming in to break up these protests, universities really wanted to move towards a campus policing model because they didn't want to be in a position where they couldn't control the students and they had to call in city police or state police or National Guardsmen who would often escalate the situation with violence. The Cornell example in particular motivated schools to have campus police departments to break up student movements before they got to the point of, as you see in the top left photo, of arming themselves. And they actually armed themselves on the second day after a group of students broke in. There were brothers from Delta Upsilon, actually, represent, who came in to try to break up the AAS and the SDS occupation of Willard Street Hall, unsuccessfully. And then afterwards, the AAS students smuggled in about 12 rifles, some of which you can see there. So Cornell wanted to stop the situation from ever getting to this point. Other schools wanted to stop having to be in a situation where they couldn't control the students and to call in the National Guard, like at Kent State. And these were two powerful motivations for creating campus police organizations to better control and to direct student agitation and political organization.
So now that we've talked about the history of policing, we're going to talk about whether there is a need for police on college campuses in the first place. So one would expect that if the numbers of police officers on campus are increasing, so would the violent crime rates, but that's actually not the case. The number of officers on college campuses has continued to expand despite decreasing rates of crime at universities. In fact, from 2004 to 2010, the violent crime rates on college campuses decreased 27%. Yet at the same time, more sworn officers with firearms, 94% more, chemical or pepper spray, 94%, taser-like devices, 40% more, and in some cases, military-grade equipment have been added to college campuses. So according to Smith, the most common crimes committed on college campuses tend to be property-related. For example, at Harvard, 95% of campus crimes involve property theft or damage. There is absolutely no need to be heavily armed to address these situations. And so I know a lot of you guys are probably wondering, like, what about violent crime rates? So violent crime rates against college students occur off campus 14 times more often than on campus. So at the University of Pennsylvania, criminologist Emily Owens finds that campus police officers are supposed to be enlisting a harm reduction model of crime control because they are supposed to be invested in student safety. Yet they haven't been. They are still armed with firearms, with pepper spray, with taser-like devices, and even military-grade equipment. These are not safe spaces for college students. So the real question that we want to ask ourselves is, what are the quote-unquote crimes that police officers are actually addressing on these campuses?
Thank you so much for that, Lucy. Just going off of that, we can look at like what's happening today, or more so in recent years, to see that the police officers in higher ed, despite their role being to more so address property related crimes or to address underage drinking, instead they're using really violent tactics that we saw back in the Vietnam War and when protests around civil rights were happening. They're using those same violent tactics to respond to community members when they are apparently tasked with our protection. Starting off with one incident in 2011, which we have a video of, UC Davis police officers were caught on film pepper spraying passive seated students who were just literally sitting. They pepper sprayed them. So, Chase, if you could go to the next slide to show that video for us.
sorry. Anyways, yes, so here are a couple news clippings where you can see some of the major incidents that have been happening. We can talk about a Black Yale student who was napping and a white student called the police on her. Smith College student who was racially profiled while eating says the incident left her so shaken she can't sleep. Black student says police barged into her dorm after white classmates allegedly made false reports. The bottom, I wasn't surprised, I was just hurt. A Black professor says campus police demanded proof. She lives in her own house. This isn't a problem that is just at Cornell. It's happening at other institutions, and it's happening all across the nation. And these are just a few of many examples of the discrimination that's happening all across. So here are a couple of testimonials. I'm not going to read every single one of them, but I'm just going to read a few. Prior to 2005, the SUNY Cortland campus, as well as two other SUNY campuses, did not permit their university police to carry lethal weapons. Here's what the students and faculty had to say. The campus now functions in peace. I see absolutely no reason for disturbing this. We do not go to school in an area that will require an armed police officer, nor do we have a history of violence at the school or among the students. I read the judicial report every month, and clearly the type of issues that UPD now contends do not call for guns. Arming the university is unnecessary, politically unwise, and morally suspect. I shudder to think one of our students being shot and perhaps killed by the university police. There are many ways to respond nonviolently to situations on campus that some think call for arming the police. As a combat veteran of the Vietnam War, there were numerous occasions when myself and my comrades had to confront and police unarmed civilians. However, the potential that someone might pose a threat always had us on the ready, with our finger on the trigger, so to speak. Sometimes this feeling of implied danger would have had undesirable results, as I know carrying a weapon can often open the opportunity for mistakes that would otherwise not have occurred. I would hate to see an incident like Kent State happen at Cortland, coming from a faculty member.
Right, so we'll talk a little bit now about the professional literature on campus police armament and on police armament more generally and its effectiveness. Unfortunately, there's not a tremendous amount of criminological literature on this. It's essentially just been assumed as an intuitive fact that police do a better job when armed, and no one's really set out to prove or disprove it or to understand the implications of it, with the exception of a few studies, which you'll see here coming from the American Sociological Association and their Division of Experimental Criminology, which actually puts some intuitive understandings of police to the test. So we'll get to those in a second. This first page has some studies from Scandinavian nations. These are researchers from Norway. They did a comparison of Norwegian unarmed patrol to Swedish armed patrol. Armed patrol meaning just police officers with handguns on their hips. They found that Swedish police shoot more often than Norwegian police, and in addition, more police and citizens are injured in Sweden. This next study, the research findings, especially that of the police officer relying on his firearm for his personal safety, are consistent with the literature in that the mere presence of a firearm on an officer enhances his or her sense of safety, but not necessarily his or her actual safety. Take, for instance, the fact that 10% of police officers shot in the United States are shot with their own firearms. Can we get the next slide, please? Right, this is from another study by Knutson and Norey to the scholars from the previous page. This is annual average number of deaths by police shooting per million inhabitants. So Finland, Norway, and England, they have a variety of police armament strategies, but each of them have a bifurcated system of armed patrol and centrally available armed responders. And in Norway, they generally have firearms in patrol vehicles, which can be employed if authorized by calling dispatch and reporting if there's a need for them. The UK has unarmed police on patrol, and they have specially trained armed police who also patrol, but who are not expected to engage in sort of community policing, community contacts that are expected of unarmed patrol officers. They're firearm specialist officers. They go through a whole series of training courses, and they are pre-staged in select locations to respond to active shooters, to terror attacks, that sort of thing. And then Denmark, Sweden, and the US all have armed patrol. Next slide, please. Right. So here we're getting into some studies that I mentioned by the American Society of Criminology. Both these studies are from the DEC, the Division of Experimental Criminology. And these are some of the most recent works in the US literature on this, and some of the only works. The first finds that unarmed police officers are similarly effective as armed police officers in deterring crime through patrol. And the second found that unarmed uniformed private security guards have a crime deterrent effect through patrol. So even if they're not duly sworn police officers with police authority, search and seizure, powers of arrest, that sort of thing, and even if they're not armed, they still have a deterrent effect on crime. Their very presence makes people less likely to commit crimes. Next slide. So this first study, again, from the DEC, this is actually a study of the UK police conducted by this American team. They found that the introduction of a new weapon system to law enforcement, in this case, the taser, to UK police. So they went from unarmed police just carrying pepper spray and batons to unarmed police carrying pepper spray, batons, and tasers, increased police willingness to deploy that weapon system and, in general, to use force to solve problems. And this next study is a comparative study of UK, Australian, New Zealand, Canadian police. Both these next two studies use the same data set and by the same team of researchers. The findings here, quote, the findings indicate that the number of fatal civilian shootings by police is higher where police are routinely armed, you know, as we can see in that graph from another publication earlier. And this second piece by these same folks, quote, overall, our analysis has found insufficient empirical evidence to support the expectation that routinely arming police officers increases community safety. And unfortunately, this is pretty much the extent of the professional literature on police armament.
Okay. All right, and so to recap, so we talked about a lot of things during this presentation. We went through the history of policing, talking about how it was rooted in slavery, slave patrols, and how it progressed throughout to what policing looks like now. We discussed a little bit about policing on campus, talking about the increased militarization of campus police, and possibly having that discussion of those funds that are used to militarize police going elsewhere, helping out in different parts of the community, talking about police brutality and the bias on campus against Black students and community members. Also having a little bit of a discussion about having police on campus, you know, making schools safer, but SUNY Cortland, you know, the testimonies that I read through refutes that. So I think that is essentially the end. Presentation, sorry. And yeah.
Great. Thank you so much to our presenters today. I do see that we have many guests in attendance, and I would like to review a few rules in accordance with our standing rules that were passed a few weeks ago for the Student Assembly. So I would like to direct everyone to Section 6 of our standing rules. Speakers will be recognized at the discretion of the chair, myself. Every speaker will have a maximum of 2 minutes to speak, and I will, I have discretion on whether to call on community members or not. So just to answer any question, because I do see in the chat that we have some people possibly wondering why they're not allowed to speak. So again, for our guests who are unfamiliar with the Student Assembly, the way it's going to go, I will recognize people on the speakers list. Again, it's at my discretion whether or not to recognize community members. I will be recognizing community members. Joe and Dakota, I do see your hands, and I will recognize them. And after I allow you all 2 minutes to speak, I will allow the presenters 2 minutes to respond. Again, this is completely in accordance with our standing rules. And for your guys' benefit, I will be sending time reminders in the chat. So I will send a 30 second reminder when your time is, when you have 30 seconds left, okay? And that's why I request that all of you, one, don't use the chat because you're going to block out the time reminders. And two, we're not allowed to be using the chat in the second, like in the first place. It's, you know, it's not on public record and it shouldn't be allowed. If you fail to respect these time limits, and again, it's completely within our standing rules that have been approved by the entire assembly, you will be muted. All right. So, and again, for our speakers, you have 2 minutes to speak. I'll set a timer and set a 30-second reminder in the chat. Please respect that time limit so we can be respectful of everyone's time. Okay. First, I am going to recognize Joel Silverstein. Also, quick comment, I'm going to put the rules in the chat so you guys can review them, but otherwise, no chat use. Thank you. Joe?
Great. Well, I appreciate you recognizing me. Thank you for that. This is the first SA meeting that I'm watching and that I'm listening to. And honestly, it's very disappointing to see the demonization of police officers, the hatred towards police officers, specifically as it relates to saying that we should totally disarm police officers. I think that's an absurd proposition. It's easy for all of you guys to say that because you're Cornell students. And as Ivy League students, you know, we talk about privilege. There's a certain privilege that comes with that, and a certain danger that you all don't have to face in dealing with crime that the police do. So that's number one. Number two, this organization also voted to cut ties with the Ithaca Police Department. And now the slides appear to suggest that we should abolish the Cornell Police Department. So is it my understanding that you guys think we should abolish the police entirely? And if so, that's an absurd proposition. And the last thing that I would just say, again, I see some of the comments that I've received in the chat for my comment in the chat. I'm not referring to the chair. I'm referring to other people who are, I guess, bystanders or members of the community. And it just goes to show that if you disagree with this opinion that I suppose a lot of people support on campus, you're harassed for it and people want to intimidate you into silence. But this is a real shame that this is happening, that this is what's being discussed. And honestly, I hope that there's a way to redirect our funds and to opt out of funding the SA in the future, because this is a disgrace.
Great. Thanks, Joe. And thank you for respecting our time. You only used 1 minute and 30 seconds, so I appreciate I didn't have to even remind you. I do have a question about the chat. I don't see any comments except for my own. So if there are other chat comments, please let me know, because again, that shouldn't be happening. I will allow the presenters to respond. So yes, go for it. 2 minutes.
Yes. Okay. To respond to that, I just have to say how disappointing that we went through this entire slide and we, you know, basically gave you the outline of the racist and horrific history of policing, not only in this nation, but the discrimination, the marginalization, the oppression that policing has done and enacted on people of color, especially Black people in this country. And if you haven't been paying attention to all of the horrific cases of police brutality that have been going on across this country, George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, countless others who have been murdered at the hands of cops at police, it makes sense that you probably don't really understand it because, like, you are coming from, you're not Black, you're not Indigenous, you're not a person of color, you don't understand a lot of these systems of oppressions that work against people of color. So to sit here and think that, our calls and our claims for wanting to disarm police that are killing people, that are literally killing people. We talked about qualified immunity. They are killing people and they're getting off with it. And there are no repercussions for their actions. People are losing their lives.
How many people in Cornell did they kill? The Cornell Police Department. How many people?
Joe, you are not allowed to respond when another speaker is speaking. Uche, back to you. You have, I'm going to give you 40 more seconds.
Thank you. Thank you. Reclaiming my time. But yes, I think that it's just highly disrespectful that we went through this entire presentation and that was all that you took from it. But of course, like, you come from a very privileged perspective and standpoint. So I guess I'm not that surprised. But if any other presenters want to give a response, feel free to do so.
Okay. Thank you, Uche. Again, I want to reiterate, according to our standing rules, I think we really need to respect procedure during this meeting. We have a very long speakers list. Please do not interrupt speakers while they are doing their piece. Again, everyone only has 2 minutes. We're sticking to our standing rules and being respectful of that. Okay. And again, in accordance with rule five from section six, equal opportunity will be given to those in favor of what has been presented on and those opposed. Considering that we just had Joe speak and then Vijay was able to respond, I'm now going to move to someone who, you know, an SA member, because again, I want to give priority to our student assembly members, and I will call on community members at my discretion. Next, we have Representative Abdel-Majid.
Hey, thank you, Kat. I just wanted to thank all the presenters for giving this really important presentation. I learned a lot as someone who does believe in disarming the campus police. And I just want to speak out and say that if you are really this astonished about this, you definitely didn't listen to the presentation because they gave a lot of points on why campus police should not be armed. But thank you so much to our presenters for doing this.
Thank you, Layla. Okay, I'm going to return to our speakers list, and I do see community members raising their hands. I will follow the speakers list in the order that I see. And Joe, I see your hand is still up. Just to clarify for everyone here, the way we do speakers list is that I will not recognize someone who has already spoken until everyone who wants to speak first has that chance. That's just the way speakers lists work in general. Okay, great. I'm now going to recognize Dakota. You have 2 minutes. Again, I will send a 30-second reminder in the chat. If you continue after your time is up, you'll be muted. And then after you speak, I will allow the presenters to respond in 2 minutes. Dakota.
Thank you very much. And thank you everyone for presenting that that power slide for me. And feel free to speak during my 2 minutes as well, because I just had a few questions. So one of the points I wanted to get to was for, you said prison labor was a term of slavery. I'm kind of failed to see how that is, because if it's for someone who was incarcerated for doing something that was breaking the law and they're getting paid for it, I don't see how that's like a form of slavery in of itself. If the police are unarmed, well, if you expect campus police to disarm themselves in the fashion that you're wanting them to, how are you expecting them to do their job when a violent outbreak or a murder happens on campus happens, or any other form of emergency? I believe there's a reason for weapons to be potentially used by police officers if the appropriate situation presents itself on campus. And let's see, what else did I write down? And by everything that you've spoken about so far, what is it that you think that ostracizing the Cornell University Police Department from the Ithaca Police Department from working together and doing training from each other is going to accomplish, especially when there's a potential, you know, shooter that comes on the campus, and then the Cornell University Police Department maybe at that time get their weapons taken away from them because that's what the school decided to, and then they're kind of left with nothing to do because now they were forced to cut off their relationship with the Ithaca Police Department. So I can definitely see where y'all are coming from. Believe me, I do. But there's also the point of more realistic situations that are tend to happening today. You know, if that makes sense. So okay. I'm just trying to understand both sides of the fence.
Great.
My drift. So
thank you so much, Dakota, for your questions. You were a little bit at time, but
I'm sorry. Continue.
Yeah, no worries. Okay. And again, presenters will have 2 minutes to speak. If I may add something really quickly on my own, in regards to your first question, when you said that incarcerated folks, you know, they're getting paid for their labor. Very often they are not getting paid for their labor. And if they are getting paid, it is minimal amounts that is completely unacceptable. So literally like a dollar an hour, 13 cents an hour, just to, you know, provide some context, but I will allow the presenters to speak now. 2 minutes, and again, I will send a 30-second reminder in the chat.
I can take this one. So firstly, going off of Kat's points, we've seen folks who are incarcerated, like being forced to fight wildfires, for example, in California. Those things are not voluntary, and they're being paid literally like nothing. This has also been like, you can watch like literally shows like Orange is the New Black, like to find out like how
folks in prison like are like not making any income. I mean, that's a fictional show for reference. That's what I'm saying. That's why it's so absurd. Besides that, in our slides, we mentioned that having police on campus has actually never stopped an active shooter, for example, one of the most violent crimes that folks are constantly saying that we need police around to protect against. They have failed to address that, which is like the prime reason that they're constantly being called upon. And then also you've mentioned the IPD resolution from last week. That's not what this resolution is about. We were talking about police disarmament, specifically in regard to CUPD. And then our job was to teach you all about this, but we also believe that it's up to the community. This should be a community-oriented approach to how we would tackle situations that CUPD would otherwise be tasked to handle. But thinking about the crimes that they actually do address, property-related things, underage drinking, they're not needing weapons to address any of those things. And they're disarmed. The presence of guns on our campus instead serves to scare residents when police officers are walking into residential dorms, stopping students who are doing things like smoking marijuana. Why do you need a gun to deal with something like that? So really thinking about what the role of police actually is will answer so many of your questions.
Great. Thank you so much, Sherelle, for that thoughtful response. Okay, I'm going to continue with the speak. Oh, sorry, Uje, did you want to go?
Yeah, I have a question. Am I able to like cede time to someone?
Yes. Technically, you guys only have about 20 seconds left if you did want to cede time to someone.
Okay.
Would you want to take advantage of that?
Yes. Could I cede some time to Mariah?
Sure. Mariah, you have 20 seconds. You can request an extension of time, and I will grant it at my discretion.
All right. Yeah, I think 20 seconds should be enough. I kind of just wanted to go off of what Sherelle was saying as far as like prison labor is slavery. Prisoners are not paid for the labor that they do. And when they are paid, it's sometimes in the 5 cents per hour type range, a dollar per day type range. And furthermore, if I remember correctly, you stole property and I didn't remember the police coming after you. And so you actually benefit from exactly what we're talking about. Thank you.
Thank you, Mariah, and thank you for respecting the time limit. I really appreciate that. Okay, great. I am going to continue with the speakers list. We still do have a few hands. Again, this meeting does go until 6:30, just so everyone is clear. Okay, Mariah, did you still want to speak independently? I see your hand is still up.
Actually, I have somewhere to be in like 3 minutes, so I don't really have time to talk, actually.
Sure, no worries. Moving with the speakers list, Uche, because you have spoken, I'm going to put you on the second speakers list. Next, we have Rachel. You are on the first speakers list, and I'm now recognizing you. Please go ahead.
Hi, thank you for recognizing me. Mine's going to be pretty quick.
Sure.
I just wanted to comment on Uche's response to Joe when he was speaking earlier, because, you know, he said maybe Joe had these opinions because he's white and in a place of privilege. But I really don't think that should matter at all when the essay is proposing that we abolish the police. And we're all students here on this campus, regardless of our race. And that affects all of us. So I think his opinion shouldn't be invalidated just because he's white. So that's all I have to say real quick.
Okay. Rachel, just to respond to your comment as chair, just to write provide context for everyone. If you weren't present actually for the presentation is about disarming the police. Rachel, I know you mentioned abolishing the police. That's not what this meeting is specifically about, just in case you were confused. I will allow the presenters 2 minutes to respond, Uche, or anyone else if you'd like to speak.
Yeah, I don't know if any of the other presenters want to respond, but to respond to Rachel real quick, this whole presentation, and I think one of the things that people should have gotten from this is the fact that this disproportionately affects Black and Indigenous people of color. So yes, there is a stark difference between the way CUPD will interact on average with white people versus Black people. I can give you countless stories of people of color who have had terrible negative run-ins with CUPD. And then on the other hand, white people who think that CUPD is the greatest thing that's happened to this campus, right? And I get it. Everybody wants to be safe on this campus, but I do too, right? I think it says something that Black people on this campus don't feel safe when they're around CUPD. Indigenous students on campus don't feel safe when they're around CUPD. Do you feel safe around CUPD? Because I don't. And I think that we really need to start digging into the reason why that is. So yeah, I don't know if any of the other presenters want to go. Connor, I see you have your hand up.
Great. Uche, I'm assuming that means you're ceding your time. Connor, if you wish to speak, you have 1 minute and 10 seconds left within your speaker's time.
Can I wait to speak and take a full 2 minutes on a different topic?
Yes, you may, Connor.
Great.
Please just keep your hand up. Uche?
Kat, is it okay if Kat...
Other Kat.
Is that, yeah.
Yes. Okay. Kat, again, you have 1 minute and 10 seconds to speak. Go for it.
I don't know if you were here for my part of the presentation where I was talking specifically about ugly laws, which basically criminalized Black disabled folks back in the 1860s to the 1890s. But those laws were passed to protect white women. So I think any person on campus needs to recognize their privilege, that a lot of laws were enacted to protect white women. So the way that the police will interact with you is very different than, say, a Black person on this campus. So it's invalid for everyone to say, oh, we're all in peace, we all should be okay with policing on campus, when police radically treat Black folks and Indigenous folks very differently. So we're not invalidating Joe's opinion, but we're just stating that he holds certain privileged identities that he needs to engage with and understand before he makes comments about how everyone should be okay with policing the way it is on campus right now.
Thank you so much, Kat. Great. Okay. Moving on with the speakers list. I see SA members have their hands raised, so I will be recognizing them. Okay. Sorry, I'm just taking a look at the speakers list right now. Okay. Uche, because you've already spoken, you're being placed on the second speaker's list. Johan has not spoken yet, so I will allow Johan, you have 2 minutes to respond. 2 minutes to ask your question or state your piece, and I will send a 30-second reminder in the chat, and that'll be followed by a 2-minute response by the presenters. Johan?
Hi, thank you for the presentation. My question is really short. You're mentioning about the disarming the police. I guess my question is, to what level disarmament? I mean, I would understand that you guys want the police to not carry, you know, active firearms. But what about, you know, less per se lethal option, for example, pepper sprays or tasers, stuff like that? What about the other, you know, typical police equipment like batons, cuffs, stuff like that? How would you guys imagine the disarmament of COPD would look like?
Okay, thank you for your question, Johan. Presenters, you have 2 minutes to respond. Just let me know if you are just going to be ceding time to one another.
Well, I can't speak to, I can only speak on behalf of myself, and I think I can only present the sort of policy suite of force options available. You know, you can start with empty hand, you can get up to less lethal weaponry, you can get into lethal weaponry. And the deployment procedures that are required to actually deploy that any sort of less lethal or lethal weaponry can also be malleable. In Norway, as in pointed out in the slides, police officers are unarmed during patrol, but then have firearms in their patrol vehicles that they can call and authorize use of in case of an active shooter or something like that. In the UK, there are specifically trained firearms officers. That's their main job. They're pre-staged at different locations, especially around urban areas, in a place like, you know, Cornell, or in a school like SUNY Cortland. Traditionally, they've had armed officers in the police headquarters who can then respond to any incidents requiring armed response. And then some other schools, they're entirely disarmed, and they rely, in case of a situation requiring or that they believe to require lethal force, then they would call in other surrounding institutions. In our case, it would be something like IPD, which has a response time for police alarms of 5 minutes.
Great. Thank you so much for that really informative answer, Connor. And Johan, thank you for your question. Moving back to the speakers list, I am going to now recognize Estefania. You have 2 minutes, and I will send a 30-second reminder if you reach that point.
Yeah, this is just a really quick comment. Just want to like have people reflect on this, but I just don't understand why some folks are heavily relying on hypotheticals of violence instead of believing a whole presentation that was just put on by these individuals about evidence regarding police brutality and like the legacy that it's fulfilled in like our campus and beyond. So I just want to like have people like reflect on that and like really just think about what was just said instead of just kind of going on ad hominem attacks on one another just because you believe a certain way and not processing information.
Thank you, Estefania. I really appreciate that, especially as according to our standing rules, we should not be resorting to ad hominem attacks at all during SA meetings, according to our procedure. Great. Okay, moving with the speakers list. Connor, your hand is still up, so I will recognize you next. You have your full 2 minutes, and I will send a 30-second reminder in the chat.
Thank you. I guess I'll speak a little bit more similar to what I was just talking about, but specifically in response to a point, Dakota Johnson's third point of active shooter incidents and this previous point that was just raised. I think that a lot of folks, you know, folks in professions, whether it be the military or law enforcement, that are backstopped by violence, that enact social control through threat of escalation to violence if the person continues to be non-compliant, that there's an, or in the national security apparatus more generally, there's an understanding that any sort of possible threat must be provided against and guarded against through any means possible and through all means possible. And I think other folks have a different perception and a different sort of weighing and a different sort of value judgment when it comes to precautions against harm that I think we heard from the previous SA member, that the likelihood needs to be considered, especially in light of the sort of ongoing harms of having that precaution in place, both in opportunity costs of, well, we're funding, you know, 60-some sworn officers for CUPD, what else could we use that the money that we're using to arm them for, the money that we're using to train them on firearms for, what could we redirect those specifically firearms funds towards instead? And I think the likelihood piece is something that I find particularly interesting. I think about Professor James Allen Fox, Northeastern's main professor of criminology, who during his time in the Bureau of Justice Statistics, he found that folks are more likely to be struck by lightning than they are to be murdered on a college campus. And I looked it up, and the last person killed by lightning in Ithaca was 1916, as best as I could figure out. Not to say that it couldn't happen, but I think that if we are expending a lot of time and effort and energy on precautions for something that's extremely unlikely, that we should think about possible other ways to use those resources.
Great. Thank you, Connor. That was really, really informative. Okay. So we have exhausted our first speakers list, which means that everyone who I wanted to speak in the first speakers list has gone. I will now allow for a second speakers list if people would like to respond. And again, sticking to our rules, 2 minutes. We are reaching close to the end of our meeting time, so it is at my discretion on whether or not to limit the speaking time in the future. Just be aware that I may be doing that in case we start to go over. And actually, I see we have someone still on the first speakers list. So Salam, go ahead.
Hi, thank you, Kat. I just wanted to confirmation before I go on. The main difference between Cornell Police and Ithaca Police is that Cornell Police don't require basic police training, police academy training, correct? If any of the presenters know, by any chance.
CU Police attends full police officer training. They attend the same, not the same training center, but they have the same qualification standards as any other police officers.
Okay, that was just my quick question. But aside from that, I really just wanted to thank the presenters for coming out today and doing all this research. It was a very informative presentation. And I believe that everyone who's in attendance today could really benefit from this knowledge, especially those with lack of awareness.
Great. Thank you so much, Salam. And I would also really like to echo your sentiments and thanking the presenters. I am aware that some guests came into the meeting late and probably missed a bit of the presentation. It had some really informative slides that I think everyone would benefit from reviewing. If you like the slides, let me know and we can see if the presenters are willing to share them so you can review them on your own time. But great. Okay. So, again, our first speakers list has been exhausted. We're now going to move to the second speakers list. Joe, you're on the you're the first person on the second speakers list. Go ahead. Again, you have 2 minutes, and I'll send a 30-second reminder once you hit that point.
So a few points I wanted to make. The first is I want to thank Rachel, and I agree with Rachel that it is inappropriate to suggest that my opinion is somehow invalid by virtue of my skin color. And that's actually in direct contrast with what heroes like Martin Luther King and many others fought for. So that's number one. Number two, I want to re-ask the question that I asked previously, which is how many students on campus were shot by CUPD officers in the last year or even in the last 3 years? And I would suspect the number is zero. So that's the second point I want to raise. And then just to make something clear that the other cat said, that I said that everyone should be fine with policing on campus. I never said that everyone should be fine with the policing on campus. So I don't appreciate people putting words in my mouth or distorting my position. What I said is that it's a reckless idea to either disarm the police or abolish the police. I never said I would be opposed to moderate reforms, but that's not where this is coming from. This is coming from a movement of fundamentally hating the police. And the last thing I would say as well is a couple of people also said that I could speak on this issue, but that I have to first recognize my privilege. And that's really an attack and limitation on free speech, because what you're telling me is that I have to agree with you that the institution of policing is systemically racist, and that if it's not, I'm not entitled and I don't have a right to speak. So that's reckless. That's against the First Amendment. That's against everything this country was founded on. Thank you.
Okay. Joe, thank you for your clarification. I would like to respond to one of your points just because I think it's relevant for everyone in the meeting. I think you mentioned that you believe this is, that I believe you specifically said that this is coming from hating the police. And you previously, you had said that you don't want people putting words in your mouth. I don't believe anyone who presented specifically said that they hate the police. And I would also appreciate it if folks, if in the same way, in the same respect, people wouldn't put words in the presenter's mouth. But I do appreciate his clarifications. Thank you, Joe. I will allow the presenters, again, 2 minutes to respond, and you will have, and I'll send a 30-second reminder in the chat. Go ahead and let me know if you would like to cede your time.
I can respond really quick to like one of the other points, because the other two didn't really make sense to me. But the first thing, only thing I really would like to say is like, please don't disrespect Martin Luther King and use him as a way of like trying to justify the fact that like you just did not understand that this entire presentation that we went through, and it's quite obvious to me that like you're being a little woefully ignorant about some of the plight and struggles that people of color are going through, especially at the hands of policing. And it's quite disrespectful to invoke Martin Luther King and everything that he stood for to try and find some way to twist it and justify. No one is singling. Anyways, if any of the other presenters want to respond to that, that'd be great.
I'd also like to point out that it is an infringement on your free speech for you to recognize your privilege being a white man. You need to come to reckon with how police radically, drastically, differently interact with folks of color than they do to students of color on campus. So it's not an attack on you, but it's rather like a call for you to do some education, looking into the history of police brutality that we just presented, and understanding how racial injustice affects folks' lives here on campus. I'd also like to say that if this presentation isn't, like, we can provide you this teaching if you would like. Understand that, like, we're not trying to infringe on your, like, first, like, right of speech. Like, we are just here to educate folks on police brutality and the ways in which we believe that the disarmament of police should happen.
Great. Thank you so much, Kat. And I do want to echo that, just again, if people aren't aware, there is no resolution today. This was simply an educational teach-in. That has been what this meeting is about. Okay. Great. Thank you for that dialogue. I really appreciated it. I see one more hand on the speakers list. This is from a community member, and I'd like to recognize Alicia. You have 2 minutes to speak.
Hi. I have a thought that I want to pose, maybe not towards Joe specifically, but people who find themselves sharing his sentiments as he's speaking. When we ask questions like who has been murdered by a police officer on campus in the past 3 years or in the past year,
I just want to ask, why are we waiting for a student to be murdered by police for us to even start considering disarming our police? Just the idea that you'd want to put someone in danger or maybe like lose another student's life before you even think about the things that students of color have been saying for more than the past 3 years, but decades. Yeah, that's it.
Okay, thank you so much, Alicia. Next on the speakers list, I want to recognize Yana, who is another community member. Yana, you have 2 minutes.
Thanks, Kat. Can everyone hear me okay? Can you hear me? Kat?
Yes, all good.
Okay, thank you, thank you. Yeah, I just wanted to briefly say that I think something that's been kind of concerning for me and some of the questioning has been around you know, framing this as like an idea of like, we are safe if the police are armed, and then we are unsafe if they're not armed, right? And instead, I just really want to emphasize that we're talking about making sure that all of our community members feel safe, not just some. And something we talked a lot about in our presentation is why a lot of our BIPOC community members don't feel safe when police are armed, particularly. And just really elevating what Alicia just said, there's no reason for us to wait for a more recent crisis on our campus to respond when we can find ways to respond to harm now, and we can find ways to preempt harm now, and we can figure out how we can support all of our community members so that nothing like that ever has to happen. Thanks.
Great. Thank you so much, Yana. Really appreciate that insight. Let me check the speakers list. Sorry, I can't see. Okay. It looks like we have no one left on the speakers list. I will do a last call if you want to be added to the speakers list, but recognizing that we only have 15 minutes left in the meeting, we will see. Okay. Again, last call for being added to the speakers list. I will leave it open for 15 seconds. Anyone want to be added to the first or second speakers list? Because Joe, I do recognize that this is your third time speaking, and I want to be respectful of the first and second speakers list. Okay. If we have no one on the first and second speakers list, Joe, I will recognize you for the third time. You have 2 minutes to speak, and I will allow the presenters to respond with 2 minutes after that.
I just want to answer my own question that I posed twice that no one specifically answered, and the answer is the number is zero. There have been zero students shot by CUPD in the last year, so I just wanted to make that clear.
Great. Thank you, Joe, for answering your question that you posed. I do also want to recognize that a student being shot by the CUPD is probably the worst possible scenario, and we shouldn't. It's an interesting situation where you're posing that as something that we have to have to move towards disarming the police. But thank you for providing clarification to your question. I will allow the presenters 2 minutes to respond. Uche or Estefania, go ahead. Sorry, Uche first, yes.
Okay, so to respond very quickly to that, I think that this is another issue that we're seeing. It's the fact that I don't think people are really paying attention to what was said. We literally should not be waiting until someone dies, gets shot, gets injured, before we start addressing some of these issues with policing. We need to take proactive measures rather than reactive. If Connor could go.
Yes, just very briefly, when it comes to the employment of armament, this comes up a lot in discussions about militarization of police and the provision of police with military equipment. We saw a little bit of this in the presentation as well with the DEC study on the equipping of UK police with tasers increased the propensity to use force. And we see similar dynamics across police departments who have accessed the Defense Logistics Agency's 1033 program to access surplus military equipment in the United States, that the agencies who access this program end up using force across the entire spectrum of force more often than they would otherwise. And the more equipment they get, the more likely they are to use force, not just to employ that equipment, but to use other sorts of force as well. So I think that we can maybe broaden this discussion to not just include the actual use of firearms, but the equipping of police officers with military-grade equipment makes them more likely to use force across the entire spectrum of force, from empty hand control methods to less lethal methods, all the way to lethal force. It works across the entire spectrum.
Thank you so much, Connor and Uche. Okay, continuing with our speakers list. Okay, Joe, is your hand still up from this comment, or did you want to respond again? Because you'll be placed on the fourth speakers list and will not be called on until everyone else has gone. Okay, great. Okay, I'm now going to recognize two folks who have not spoken at all, so they are still on the first speakers list. First, I will recognize Samuel.
I wanted to say two things. The first is that I'm starting to think that people responding to what was said in the presentation didn't listen to anything that was said in the presentation. I think that if they joined in the middle of the meeting after the presentation was over, we would have had the exact same discourse, which, you know, is kind of a letdown considering we had that long informative presentation. And the second thing I wanted to say was the fact that there should be a quota for deaths before we do something about the police makes absolutely no sense. So that's all I wanted to say.
Great. Thank you so much, Sam. I really appreciated your comment. Great. Moving now to Claire, because Claire has not spoken yet. You're on the first speakers list. I'm now recognizing you.
Hi. I'd first like to thank the presenters for putting together that really informative presentation. And I appreciate all the research that went into it. I do have a couple questions, especially as Connor just raised about the issue of militarization, which I think is an important one to discuss. I'm just not aware of how what sorts of equipment that CUPD currently has, apart from firearms, obviously. So I would be curious if anyone happened to know that. As well as, I anticipate this will be discussed more once a resolution is brought forth, but what sort of plan, the research brought up several different potential methods, such as having, for instance, like only one section of an armed force along with unarmed patrol, which I would be curious to hear more about the presenter's stances on, but of course, it's totally reasonable if this won't be discussed until next meeting.
Great. Thank you so much, Claire. I'm going to allow the presenters 2 minutes to respond if you would like.
I'll see to other folks in a minute, but to the question of equipment and CUPD militarization, we don't know what equipment CUPD has, and we don't know their use of force policy as well. That's something I think that I'll be asking for as part of the Public Safety Advisory Committee, among other things. And in regards to the different possibilities of unarmed and armed response and all on the different, deployment possibilities, I can't speak for the presenters and I can't speak for what this body, what will be presented to this body next week. But I just wanted to give a suite of the possibilities based off of what other countries do. Is there anyone else who I should cede to?
Thanks, Connor. If you are ceding time, please let me know. You guys have a minute and 30 seconds left.
It doesn't look like we are.
Okay, great. If we have no more presenters responding, I will move forward with the speakers list. Sherelle, I see that you have your hand up and you have not spoken yet, so you'll be placed on the first speakers list, and I'm now recognizing you.
I just wanted to make a quick point going back to a lot of the comments that were made regarding the First Amendment freedom of speech. So there's the idea, and this is a quote from the ACLU, dissent is patriotic. So it's the idea that going against something, going against government, going against the status quo is patriotic. So in this sense, we're trying to make a better campus. We're trying to hold Cornell to their model of any person, any study by making this an equitable, safe, and fair community for any person by disarming CUPD. We're being proactive as opposed to retroactive. We're trying to preserve, not preserve, because Cornell in many ways does not live up to that model now, but we're trying to make this institution better. And that is why we're advancing these ideals, not to squander free speech. And if anything, we're exercising our right to free speech. And you're free to disagree, but think about why you're disagreeing. What is your disagreement rooted in?
And make sure you're listening to what we're saying. Like so many other presenters said, this presentation is available for you. We urge you to really sit with it. Sit with the data and the research, because what you see in that presentation is facts, not opinion. Sit with it, think about what it means, and don't immediately try to rely on any attack you might feel regarding your own guilt around maybe your whiteness. So, yeah.
Great. Thank you so much for that thoughtful response, Sherelle. Estefania, I saw you had your hand up.
Sherelle put it into much better words than I could, so just want to bump that.
Sure. Okay, great. I see that we have no more hands left on the speakers list, recognizing also that it is 6:23 and there are no more folks on the speakers list. So technically, I think we are about done with our agenda. Presenters, do you have any last minute comments? You will have 2 minutes, and then otherwise, as chair, I will formally request a motion to adjourn.
I just want to say that if you are seeking to learn more about this topic, we're going to be sending out a document with FAQs, and we can also send you all our sources. We are currently planning on sending that document to SA members, but if you're a community member that would like to receive it, just feel free to send us a message in the chat and we can also send it to you.
Yeah, and just to add on, oh, sorry.
Go for it.
Yeah, just to add on quickly to that, if anyone wants to do like a one-on-one coffee chat before the next week or anything like that, myself and I'm sure all or most of the other presenters might be willing to do that. So yeah, if you want to learn more, we're not experts, but we're doing this work. Or reach out to the CARS Instagram, Cornell ARS on Instagram, and we can set you up with someone if you want to ask questions.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Jana and Lucy. I really want to thank everyone who came to this meeting today, whether you are a guest, a community member, or an SA member. And thank you for allowing this kind of dialogue and discourse. Again, I really appreciate our presenters' willingness to meet with folks who still have concerns, either one-on-one or through email. I would encourage folks to put your emails. Okay, if you would like the slides or if you would like to be put in touch with one of the presenters, please message me privately and I will with your email address. I will collect your email addresses and send them over to our presenters so you guys can get in touch later. I know I had folks messaging me for the slides, so I have made a note of if you did request the slides. I want to recognize the chat. Mardia suggested watching the 13th documentary on Netflix. I would also second that. It's a really, really informative documentary. Great. Okay, I'm going to allow a few seconds for folks to privately message me if you would like those slides or if you would like to be put in touch with the presenters. And just shoot me your email address as well. Awesome, I see a few requests coming in. I really appreciate that. I'll be collecting the email addresses. Great. Again, I'm seriously so thankful for everyone who are taking this time to learn more about this. It's definitely an educational process for all of us and there is a learning curve, but again, thank you so much. Okay, I'm gonna allow 15 more seconds because I still have requests coming in. Again, thank you so much to everyone who is asking. Okay. 10 more seconds if you would like to message me to request the slides. I have a lot of requests. I'm so thankful to see that. Okay. I think I have most people's names. I'm just going to copy my chat right now. Great. If you have messaged me, you'll be receiving an email from our presenters. Thank you so much to our presenters who took the time to put together that presentation and speak with members from the community today. As chair, I would look favorably upon a motion to adjourn.
Motion to adjourn.
Second. Great.
Okay. There's a second. Is there any dissent? All in favor of adjourning, please unmute and say aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Wonderful. That is majority. Okay. Have a wonderful night, everyone. Goodbye.
This has been a production of Cornell University. On the web at cornell.edu.